Welcome to Podcast Ed, the podcast of RedefinedOnline.org, covering the stories behind the new definition of public education. On this episode, Step Up for Students President Doug Tuthill talks to Representative Robert Boehning of Indiana's 91st House District in Indianapolis. Rep. Boehning was the sponsor of HB 1005, a $10 million education savings account that was ultimately passed as part of the state's budget. The two discuss the legislative process of expanding choice in Indiana, the motivation behind expanding the state's already robust choice options, how public school districts stand to benefit, and improving on issues such as transportation for the programs in the future. Thank you for listening, and enjoy the episode.
So I'm really pleased today to have Representative Robert Boehning from Indiana. He represents District 91 in Indianapolis. Welcome, Representative.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So we're very excited to talk about the tremendous success you had in the legislative session this year. I first want to give our listeners a quick overview of the various education choice programs in Indiana, because you have historically led the country and providing families with diverse sets of choices. You have the Choice Scholarship Program, which is basically a voucher program for low-income kids. You have the newly passed Education Scholarship Account, which is a flexible, we call them ESAs in Florida, but it's a flexible spending account that folks can use for special needs services, therapies, transportation, et cetera. You have a tax credit scholarship program, similar to the ones we have in Florida. And you also have a tax deduction for homeschool and private school families who can get a tax deduction to offset expenses for private schools and homeschooling. So again, Indiana has historically led the country in education choice. And so first I wanna congratulate you on that, and also on, I think, a fairly productive legislative session. So I'm interested in House Bill 1005. It had a very interesting career in the session. I guess I'm curious, what was the motivation behind the bill? What were you all trying to accomplish? Let's start there. Yeah, give me a little context as to what was motivating you to file 1005.
Well, there's a lot of factors that come together, I think, when you look at legislation. We were the first year of a second-term governor. If you think back, Indiana really had a big push forward in 2011 when Mitch Daniels started his second term with us having a majority. We'd been in the minority. Republicans had been the minority in the past and in the House. So we had come into the majority. It's a decade. So there was just a lot of growing pains, people feeling like we'd made huge success moving forward in choice options over the whole decade, because not only in private school choice, we also have expanded things like innovation network schools, charters. We've had public school choice. There's been a lot of change over the last decade and a half. But so it's just kind of a great time to make it happen. And then the other thing had become very clear is that when we initially passed choice scholarship law in 2011, we had created, it was means tested, but we also had stair-stepped the amount of support. So if you were at 100% of free and reduced lunch, you got 90%. Then it dropped down to if you between 101% and 149%, you got 70%. And that number, originally when the bill passed, it was in 11, it was 90% and dropped to 50 over the period of time we'd had this stair step where we put in like 70-75%. We decided that in this session, let's just make it 90% of it constantly for everyone. So we know that when it came down to secondary, that it becomes much more problematic if I have to pay half of the cost of secondary as opposed to having 90% of it being paid by the state. So ESAs, we really wanted, there's been a lot of energy in the state over the last several years to add ESAs to the state. You know, I've kind of had some level of question whether it makes sense because our voucher law is very, very broad. With COVID and the dynamics of consumers actually wanting to be able to buy services maybe independently, the ESAs provide that in a much better way than a voucher would. Right. So it kind of made sense for us to get into that. And we actually, I would have preferred to have a little bit broader. I wanted to add in active duty military initially was the way the bill passed, as well as we also wanted to include foster youth. We ran into some issues. The Senate was not, historically, the Senate's not quite as excited about choice as House Republicans are, even though they are more Republican than the House. So we have to kind of tenor that a little bit, but ended up with, I think, a solid bill in the end. It still didn't go as far as I would like and some of us like, but it at least gets it. And the Speaker and I, one reason we are limited on ESAs as opposed to, I think West Virginia went universal, is there is a little bit of concern about making sure that we implement this with fidelity and start out a little bit slow, more slowly. The Speaker and I have had a lot of conversation about let's get our foot in the door and kind of start walking with it, making sure that we make sure there's no fraud issues. Because you hear about the stories in Arizona, in fact, that kind of demonized the whole discussion along the way is all the fraud issues. And I was recently with a senator at a club meeting, GOP club meeting, who said that we're giving them a debit card. I'm like, no, we're not giving them a debit card. That's not the way this works. But unfortunately, I myself thought that's the way it works. So I think that's the perception out there. So how do we put this together in a way that I think creates confidence in the community as well with legislators that we could do this and really do it and make a difference for kids and do it without having fraud?
Just out of curiosity and not to get you in any trouble, but why would the Senate in Indiana be less open to choice than the House? Is there something systemic in the politics in Indiana that maybe other states would also experience?
Yeah, well, I think House and Senate, you know, which is true in most states, Senates represent larger districts. Yeah. In Indiana, which is a struggle for choice, and I think across the country, is that Republicans tend to be the drivers of choice in most states. I mean, you see red states doing this, not blue states, but I look at it as a social justice issue, and I look at it as really providing opportunities for people, for parents that don't have the ability to make a choice by moving to a community where the schools are better, that we're giving them some other option. I think that the political pressure of the local school communities, traditional school districts, is significantly different. You know, you in Florida have countywide districts. We do not. And we've got some rural counties that, like one rural county has 5 school districts. The total enrollment for all of them is less than 4,000. And I know that sounds like a lot compared to some communities, some states as well. But, you know, each one of those has a community of interest that puts pressure on those senators. My colleague that's a chairman of the Senate Education Committee represents one of those counties, and he's a big advocate of choice, been very supportive. But he, you know, is constantly telling me how his school districts are constantly pushing on him that, you know, they're demonizing him because it's this perception of we versus they, or, you know, it's always you're taking money away from us. The irony of this year's session was that we put it into the budget bill. So we ran 1005 separately. When it got to the Senate, they had run a similar ESA bill. Ours was a little bit broader in terms of the expanse of the way it was implemented. But they ended up deciding to put it in the budget bill. And so the irony of it was that we actually had in the House every single Democrat voted for school choice this year because we expanded it. And so the minority, because it was Indiana's been very fortunate we've actually had the turnaround in Indiana from post-COVID has been very robust. Our employment is lowest in the Midwest. We have 3.9% unemployment. Right now, we have 115,000 job openings. I was at a grocery store last night, and they're just desperate for help. And so it's a situation where we had a lot more projected revenue. So we had a big increase in public K-12 funding. We did a lot more for charters. And then, you know, it was like, well, okay, I'll take it. You know, it's kind of like, we'll accept this expansion of choice.
Are families with ESAs able to spend that money in school districts?
Sure. Now, you cannot be enrolled in a, if you're going to be on an ESA, you cannot be enrolled in a choice school. You cannot be enrolled in a traditional, you can't be enrolled in a school. But the way the ESA would work is you could buy services from the local public school district. You can buy it from a charter school. You can buy it from a non-public school. Or you could use that and buy the services and technically buy all the services you want from the school of your choice. It really is an option for parents that are going to have to be pretty smart consumers as well. We're going to do everything we can over the next few months to make sure that we educate and help make certain parents understand. But we had a couple of scenarios that actually played very favorably into a special ed ESA because we have had the US DOE investigating our Department of Education over allegations that IEPs were not met under COVID. Appropriate services were not provided. And I think it's been one of the first time in state history that that's happened. In fact, one of the school districts just north of Indianapolis was almost always doing virtual. And it was all over the media that there was a parent whose kid desperately needed that face-to-face interaction, and the school district refused. So there's, I think, a lot of energy right now with special ed parents saying, hey, I want to be able to pick the best thing for my kids, not just what is available in my local school district. That may not, in 90% of the case, that may be the local school district, but this gives them the option to really make some choices that best meet their needs.
I'm wondering if over time school districts might buy in because they're able to actually unbundle their services and begin to sell services to families with ESAs if you guys expand it. You know, we've done the same thing in Florida. We've made public school districts a vendor and families can spend their ESA dollars at school districts. Right now, the school districts don't seem to be interested because we only got like 20,000 kids on ESAs. And I think it's in a state this size, the pool isn't large enough, I think, for school districts to think about that. But I'm wondering in the future if maybe as ESAs expand, if school districts might become a little more entrepreneurial and be willing to spend the time to unbundle their services. And that might create some common ground politically.
You know, I will say, you know, we often look to Florida because I like the fact that countywide does, I think, create a lot more efficiencies maybe in terms of delivery. I don't have to have like that small county.
Yeah.
I mentioned Wayne County that has five school districts. I have five superintendents, five transportation directors, five, HR people. You know, if you could make that one, and that's still not a very big school district, I'd say probably the disadvantage is, though, is you probably don't have the ability for competition. And since we are an open enrollment state in public school choice, I really believe that you will see our traditional pubs see this as an opportunity early on because of the fact that it's so transparent and so easy to move back and forth in between districts. I had one of my, as a lobbyist, as a former staffer for House Republicans, reach out to me and last night wanted to know about the quality of one of the school districts that I represent. And she lives in a different community and she's not satisfied with it. And she's thinking about moving to that. So because of that, I mean, we have our school districts that are advertising, traditional public schools advertising, you know, different, our grad rate is X, you know, come enroll in our school. And so I think we'll see our public schools offer that. Now, I will tell you that one caution that ARC of Indiana, which I know ARC is part of a national organization representing kids with disabilities, one of their concerns, and we work very closely with them on this language, ESA language, is that some of our traditional public schools may say, well, I'll let them buy the services somewhere else and I'm not going to try to provide it. Obviously, state law and federal law requires them to continue to provide that, but I think we work very closely, and I would recommend, especially if you're going down the walk with a special needs ESA or program, I would closely recommend that you very closely work with the special ed community. The last thing we wanted to do is advocate. We have a great ESA program and have the groups that represent them say, well, we think it's a horrible idea. So,
yeah. Is there a cap in terms of enrollment on your ESA, and how much money is available per
it's,
child?
It's capped at $10 million.
Okay.
So, which we were always, I was a bit frustrated going into session, because I was capped at my whole program having to be less than $60 million new spending in the biennium. We do a biennial budget, and everything's, when we first introduce the budget, it's all based on our fiscal forecast from December. And we could see the tea leaves showing revenue was increasing. I mean, our February sales tax revenue blew away. It was $100 million over what it was in 2020, which really was 20. You know, I think 20 was a strong year, and COVID hadn't hit yet. So we could see the tea leaves shifting, but I was restricted because we started in the, this was in January. It was before it moved to the second house. And we, all of us had to do, I constantly would tell people, because they were like, well, the budget this, the budget that, you're taking, we were criticized for taking such a large chunk of what was perceived to be new money for choice. And I'm like, just be patient. It's like a dance, you know, there's four different stages in this process. And we will, the last is where we get our fiscal forecast in April, and that kind of changes the whole picture. So
did the federal money make a big difference? I know in Florida, it was pretty much a game changer here.
Actually, no, the federal money, we did not use any, none of the federal money was used. We, our forecast is just that strong. We actually increased K-12 spending by almost $1.5 billion, something like that. And our forecast was super strong. Like I said, we have the lowest unemployment in the Midwest. Our federal money is just additional money. We came into COVID with a surplus. We're a fairly fiscally conservative state. We did not spend down all of our reserves. So we actually, we spent one-time expenses. I mean, we spent more money this time. This was a great session for me as education chair, because we had $150 million learning loss appropriation, one-time appropriation for learning loss that, now we do say you have to use federal money first, but we're looking at all sorts of creative ways to go after learning loss. And that was all state money, because the state had enough reserves and this new fiscal projections. We put money into trying to help the businesses that have been hospitality, mostly have been most adversely impacted by COVID. And so it was really this federal money. I think we would all have to say that the federal money that probably helped us most was the federal money that started last year, because that started the economy starting to pick up, and consumer spending helps drive, obviously, state revenue. So,
yeah, of course, the challenge of the federal money, it's not non-reoccurring, so you got to be careful that you don't make an investment. I think in Florida they use a lot of it to beef up reserves, and because, you know, they spent down. They also, in Florida, we also are fairly conservative, and we didn't spend down all of our savings account, but we did take some. So I think they replenished some of that, and they did some one-time bonuses to employees in the state that, you know, as a way to say thank you for a lot of things that they were doing. So it is tricky with that non-reoccurring money. You got to be careful, kid. You can get yourself in trouble.
Yeah, we did set the stage by paying down some retirement debt.
Yeah.
Because that eliminates, that's a one-time payment, eliminates long-term obligation, which gives the state the ability to, next biennium, to look at ways to reallocate those funds that were utilized for that.
What about moving forward? What are your thoughts about additional improvements to the choice programs in Indiana? What are you thinking?
One of the frustrations I have that I think we need to figure out a way to kind of mitigate the impact is transportation.
Yeah.
How do you provide transportation to choice? I have been talking to some of the community leaders. We actually had a bill drafted that looked at trying to consolidate traditional public school transportation systems. In Indianapolis, for instance, there are 11 traditional public school districts. 10 of the 11 provide transportation. One of them is Speedway, Indiana, where the Indianapolis Motor Speedway is, and they actually walk to school, so they don't have a bus system. But all the rest of them have bus transportation system. And, you know, as I go, I live on the southwest side. I work on the northwest side. As I drive up to work or go to work out, I frequently will see a school bus from a southern school district in the north or vice versa. And so we're looking at trying to figure out ways to maybe, number one, provide more efficiency. We're looking at P3s that might be able to consolidate that and then be agnostic as to where the student's going to school.
Yeah.
So that you could provide for kids of parents who've made a choice, they don't have to provide transportation. They're technically paying for it. Indiana is a little bit unique because our schools are funded totally by state dollars. The general fund dollars come from the state. Mm-hmm. We do not have, unless they do a referendum that's supplemental. They can do a supplemental referendum property tax, but all of the property tax dollars, I mean, all of the general fund dollars come from the state. So schools get debt service, capital project, and transportation. So every parent's paying for that transportation, even if they're not receiving any service. So we're looking at ways to be, number one, be more efficient about it, which we could drive more money to teacher salaries, et cetera. Number two would be to provide more services for kids to be able to go to school of their choice. And then charter side, we're looking at another model we're looking at is trying to figure out, is there a way that we can maybe move to a building authority, countywide building authority, that would be not controlled by it'd be more like a board that would allocate services to the highest and best use rather than saying this school district gets to use it. I think it helps get schools out of the business of owning buildings. And I think it also would be a really great way for us to provide more facilities for some of our charters and look at opportunities to really help equalize that a little bit, because that's a struggle we have. I think most states do. How do you provide facilities for charters? And we increased the charter facility funding in Indiana this session, first year. The biennium, it will be $1,000 per student. Second year, it goes to $1,250. But it's estimated that a traditional public school student pulls down, and this is in transportation, debt service, and capital projects, almost $3,400 for each student. So, you know, the charter is getting a third of it, essentially. And how do you kind of equalize that over time? So we're looking at a couple of options like that. And then, obviously, the ESA long-term, I would love to be able to see us grow that and make it available to more. I really am a huge advocate of CTE, modern youth apprenticeships, things like that. And is there a way we could use the ESA to kind of really blow that up too, so that kids, you know, don't have to necessarily use just the services of the community they live in, but they could, you know, if they want to be do something in industrial engineering or advanced manufacturing they don't have in their community, they can use some of those dollars and follow up there. So I think there's a lot of opportunities still to expand.